All right, everyone, we might get started. I think we all know the drill by now. Rebecca will talk for 25, 30 minutes and you guys can ask some questions. I'll just ask you to jump up to a microphone if you have a question at the end. So Rebecca Nielsen is a Behavioural Insights Program Specialist at Employers Mutual. In a current role, Rebecca is working with Department of Premier and Cabinet Behavioural Insights Unit to pilot an alternative case management model to support medically discharged New South Wales police officers. Rebecca is working concurrently on a business-wide project focused on enhancing written communication using the principles of behavioural insights. Prior to this, Rebecca was responsible for the medically discharged and whole person impairment portfolios in the role of group manager at Employers Mutual. Rebecca has qualifications in psychology and a master's in business, personal injury, as well as a passion for improving personal and professional outcomes by focusing on creativity, interpersonal connections and communication. Please give Rebecca a welcome.
Thanks, Phil. I'm really excited to be here today to share a bit with you about the Behavioural Insights project that's currently underway at Employers Mutual in New South Wales. We have had the exciting opportunity to partner in a really unique way with the Department of Premier and Cabinet's Behavioural Insights team on this project. We started in March this year and we'll be running up until the end of this year. So we're in a really exciting phase of the project right now. So I'll be sharing some of what's happened so far with you. I'd like to start out, though, today with giving you a little bit of context of where we sit in the personal injury scheme at the moment in terms of the underpinning theories that we've currently built our scheme on and that we're working within. I'll then take you through and explain a little bit about how the behavioural insights approach fits into that context. And finally, I'll give you a bit of an insight into our project. So in preparation for this presentation, I did a bit of a scan of the recent history of the Australian and New Zealand scheme environments. And what that revealed to me was a real friction between two types of model. The first model being the medical model of recovery, and there's a huge shift in our thinking that I've seen lately, and there's a lot of work being done to try and move us away from a traditional medical or biomedical approach to thinking about injury. So what is a medical model? That model is where we look at the diagnosis as the primary source of information that tells us something about that person and their experience and how we might profile their claim and how we might support them in their recovery. So because of that, the doctors and the providers tend to be the main focus and we tend to push our worker along. Our injured person is quite passive in that process. So I said that there was a bit of a friction there and having a look at the evidence around this friction's not new. And researching this, I came across a quote from Hippocrates where he seemed to be commenting on this friction and that it seems to have been happening for some time. So about 2,000 years ago, Hippocrates noted that it's more important to understand the person that the disease has than to understand the disease that the person has. So this tells us ultimately what the problem with the medical model is, and that's by focusing on one aspect of a person that we miss really essential and useful information. So what's the impact of that? When the diagnosis fails to predict return to work for someone in a scheme using the medical model, they then become caught up in a really adversarial system, which, and I think Carolyn showed her slide this morning to show a bit about what that looks like for someone. Lots of medico-legal appointments and assessments, legal providers get involved, and we move further and further away from where we actually need to be in helping a person recover, and we move more towards an adversarial model that we know is not really a good investment of our time and resources. So the model that we're trying really hard to move towards is the biopsychosocial model of recovery. So this model puts the person at the centre of our focus and attention, and this is the model that is being proposed by the World Health Organisation in the ICF, which is the classification system to help us talk and think in the same language about disability across the world. George Engel, was a psychiatrist who developed this theory. And what he did was, rather than overcomplicating things, he looked at the medical model and said that that does a lot of good, but we're just going to add a couple of things to that model. And those things were the social context of the individual and the psychological factors that are really critical to us understanding how an injury will impact on their life. So I think Engel and Hippocrates would have got along quite well, even though they were 2,000 years apart. So how do we now, we're all here today and tomorrow trying to figure out how to make our schemes better. So how do we do that, knowing what we know, and use the biopsychosocial model more effectively? We can see by looking at the scheme, South Australia is using some of the underpinnings of the biopsychosocial model with their medical, with their mobile case management approaches. New Zealand are using these underpinnings as well. There seems to be a real move towards this, but how do we shift in a more holistic way towards the biopsychosocial model? So in my estimation, that's where behavioural insights comes in and can help us to do that. So when having a look into how behavioural insights has come into the return to work area and the policy area, we saw the text, the nudge, back in 2008. So what the nudge wants to do for us is to add more information, like Engel did, to the medical model, more information about human nature, which was missed by the traditional economic theories. So nudge, or behavioural economics, or BI, behavioural insights, they're all very similar terms. If you are using any of those terms, they probably all mean quite the same thing. We now know a little bit more about how people actually behave by looking at this new information that's come out through the nudge, and also through the Nobel Prize winner David Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. So the themes to these types of thinking is that we know we've got one type of thinking, which is that rational mind, which is the centre of the traditional economic theory. What behavioural economics gives us is a little bit more information about the thinking model that we use when we make decisions that maybe aren't in line with what our actual motivation is. So why do we choose to eat the bad food when we really want to be healthy? Why do we not exercise when we really want to, and we've got true motivation to do these things, but we just can't get ourselves there? So the key to the nudge that we've seen is that it helps us understand people better so we can communicate with them better rather than blaming them when things go wrong. So the key to the nudge is really about choosing how we communicate, drawing attention to certain facts that will help people move in a direction they actually want to move into, which is really useful in return to work. So the way that it's come along to the New South Wales government area is that the Behavioural Insights Unit was born, or the nudge unit in the UK. The New South Wales government were early adopters of this approach back in 2012. And they've got a dual aim. They need to work on better service delivery for complex policy areas, and that's how they've come to us, to look at the medically discharged police space. And they're also, we've heard a lot today about transforming service culture to improve outcomes, and that's another focus area for the BI team in New South Wales government. So there's a few headline results so far that I wanted to show you today for the Behavioural Insights team. They have worked in the areas of fines and taxes, in the area of public hospitals, and also in return to work. Their work in fines and taxes led to 60,000 late fees being avoided, which translates to $4 million in admin savings in the first year. They unlocked an extra $11 million for a public hospital just by helping frontline staff in the hospital to unlock some of that private health insurance that people had that were coming into the hospitals. So that's gone back into frontline services. And finally, and most relevant to us, a partnership between the Department of Education and Communities and Allianz in the Treasury Managed Fund in New South Wales, using behavioural insights approaches, saw a 27% improvement in return to work over the first 90 days of a claim by using these different approaches to thinking about how we interact with people. So that brings us to our trial. Now, we have very good reasons for wanting to invest in doing things differently for this portfolio of medically discharged officers. The return to work trial results of Allianz were exciting. We also, the context for us in the last couple of years in the medically discharged portfolio has been quite dire. The projections from the actuarial perspective were telling us that once medically discharged, a police officer was expected to remain on benefits for life. So the social, community and financial impact of that was huge, and we knew we had to do something about it. So this opportunity was really exciting for us, and we really embraced it with both hands. So what we've got then is a large portfolio of people who are police officers who have been medically discharged, and for those people that they talk about their role as a police officer as a vocation rather than a job. We have people who are grieving for the loss of that vocation. They're in complex financial situations with the complexities of workers' comp, often and most often overlaid with at least two or most often three other types of financial support through super and income protection insurance. And what this led to for us was a lack of trust. So we talked a little bit in other sessions today about adversarial systems leading to lack of trust and it making really, really difficult for us to then re-engage with people and help them return to life and return to work. So we had a situation in 2014 where not only were the officers, their families and our communities and the scheme at risk, but our case managers were also at risk due to these issues spilling onto social media and people being targeted, our case managers being targeted specifically on social media. So our trial aims to change all that and to focus on case management in a different way where the key objectives are engagement and enhancing the way that we currently support our medically discharged officers. Now, the model that the Behavioural Insights approach always tries to use is one of a controlled trial, so where you can really measure and test the effectiveness by having half of your sample, in most cases, using the current business-as-usual approaches and the other half using the new approaches. So you can really test along the same context and environment whether this thing works. So we have a number of interventions in the trial, and I've only brought a few to talk to you about today. The first one is courtesy calling. Now, this sounds so simple, but the context that we were in, as I talked about a minute ago, was one where there was lack of trust. We're working with people who are particularly unwell, a lot of them, and because of that, the preference for communication was email communication. So you all know email communication isn't great if you're trying to build rapport. So what we asked our case managers to start doing back in March this year was to think differently about their communication, start making calls, working through the issues when we had a large number of our medically discharged officers saying, please don't call me. I prefer that you just email me, and being very protective of themselves, to moving through to an approach where really aligned to that service culture that we've talked about a bit today as well, and just picking up the phone and saying, how can I help you today? It sounds simple, and I think for our case managers who have been around for a long time, it was quite uncomfortable because they're used to being the person responsible for pulling and pushing things along. So it was a really interesting time for us in terms of a change management approach, getting our case managers to think about this as being something that could be positive for both for them and for the medically discharged officers. And I'll talk in the next few slides about the outcomes of that intervention. The centrepiece of the trial is really about handing back to our medically discharged officers their own planning for their recovery, so engaging them in the planning approach, handing the reins back over and really reinforcing that this is your life, this is your recovery, how can we help you with your plan? So to do that, we're using the functions that the levers that the injury management plan gives us in our legislation in New South Wales, but we're changing the words. So instead of talking about planning an injury, we're talking about planning your recovery. This is your recovery plan. And we are asking our case managers to support people in developing personalised goals that tie to their personal values and working through in a really detailed way how they're going to achieve that, linking into their community networks, and finally then thinking about how the case manager can support them. So really putting their recovery in their lap but providing them with every chance to succeed. So you can see that the recovery plan really brings together those concepts that I've talked about of the biopsychosocial model and behavioural insights, about identifying that people are more than just an injury, and thinking about how we can be more positive and consider their social environments, their personal needs. And a big part of what was successful in the UK, so the UK team came to us with success from a job centres trial, which was all about using personal commitments that we know from psychology and probably from your own lives. If you make a personal commitment to do something, like if you're trying to start exercising, if you make a personal commitment with a friend to go for a walk, you're more likely to follow through on that commitment. If you make a commitment that others can hear, our ego makes us want to keep that commitment. So personal commitments are really powerful with motivation, and the success of the return to work trial in the job centres in the UK was really centred around how do we get people to make really powerful personal commitments, because we know that it's more likely they'll follow through. So we're using the recovery plan as a tool to help people develop these personal commitments that they're making, they're declaring to their case manager, they're declaring it to their treatment providers, and this is what they want for themselves. So because of that, the evidence shows that it's more likely they'll actually be successful with their planning. The last piece on this slide is one of the pieces of training that we provided to our case managers. So we're asking them to do a lot, and we're asking them to do things very differently. So we needed to arm them with some theory and some research findings that will help them feel more confident and motivated to do this. So I'll talk in over the next couple of slides about Carol Dweck's mindsets theory. So our training for our case managers involved the theory and findings of the mindsets theory, as well as some really interesting evidence around neuroplasticity that shows the brain is a lot more like a muscle than we ever realised, and that by learning how to flex that muscle of our brain, that we can actually build the brain in ways that we never knew before. And by using that evidence, bringing a lot of hope to our case managers where there was none. A lot of people medically discharged from police have been told that PTSD is for life and that they should give up hope, that nothing is ever going to improve. So this training in mindsets theory and neuroplasticity is really important for our case managers to see that there is hope, and to then translate their hope onto their medically discharged officers. So a little bit more about mindsets theory. I added a couple of slides on mindsets theory because I think it's really personally useful as well as interesting to learn about what we're doing in the trial. So Carol Dweck has done a huge amount of work in early education but also adult education, and she has found in working with children and then adults that people tend to fit into one of two camps. So the first being that they have a fixed mindset about intelligence. So what you've got, you're born with it and you'll die with it, basically. There's nothing you can do about your intelligence. But there's this other really interesting and very adaptive camp where people who are most successful sit, which is that of the growth mindset, where intelligence is fluid. And what's really interesting is about these people is that they have more internal motivation to learn new things. They persist in the face of setbacks. They embrace challenges. And because of all that, they have higher and higher levels of achievement throughout their life. When I talked to one of my colleagues at work about this theory, she got really excited about it. And she said, I was just reading this book about called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. I don't know if many of you have heard of Viktor Frankl, but he's quite an inspirational figure who is a concentration camp survivor and also a psychiatrist, and he did some wonderful things in his life. And one of the beautiful things that he left us was his experiences in concentration camps, where he saw the differences in that extreme setting between people, and it was purely around their mindset. People who had a positive mindset and something to hope for survived. And the quote that I chose to share with you today about that that Victor gave us was really useful, I think, for thinking about long-term injury and illness, which is that between stimulus and response, there's a space. And that in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. And for us, we want to give that to our case managers. We want to give them that space and we want to help them pass that space and that excitement and opportunity on to their medically discharged officers. So this is the final mindsets theory and I'll move on from there, I promise. But this is the slide that I really like to help talk to our case managers about. It's a really visual representation of the mindsets theory and that in it is inherently in it is it's your choice. So you can choose either one of these. You can choose the failure frame and choose the closed window, and that's okay and that's probably pretty safe, but it's probably also risky in ways that we don't even think about. And that's where if you come up against something, you try something new and it doesn't work the first time, you decide, okay, I'm not made for this, I'll just give up. Or you can choose the experience frame, like the kids that Carol Dweck saw that inspired her research and her theory, who are the kids that they find this new problem and they get excited by it because they can't wait to see how they're actually going to overcome it. So we really want that model, that experience frame, to be the model that our case managers are choosing for themselves and for the people they're responsible for. So this is a little bit of a sexy checklist that the Behavioural Insights team have developed, and I think it's really nice that it's easily available, it's quite pretty, and it's really useful for anyone who's interested in enhancing written communication approaches. It can be used for policy review, so I definitely recommend if you're interested in behavioural economics to have a look at this. We use this checklist along with the expertise of our co-partners in the Behavioural Insights team in New South Wales to revise the suite of letters that we send to the medically discharged officers. So it's got some very useful tips and it's a nice little mnemonic that helps you think about your communication. Is this communication making it easier for the person to understand what they need to do? Are we making things as easy as possible for them? Are we attracting people's attention to the right things that'll help them do what they need to do? Are we thinking about the timing of our information and giving people appropriate time to do things we need them to do? And are we using what we know about humans as being social creatures rather than purely rational beings to frame this information? So the example that I've brought along for you of one of our before shots of our introduction letter. So with all good intentions, we like to give people lots of information as humans and we think that that will help them. I talked a lot about the context that we're in. So you can just imagine for a medically discharged officer grieving, struggling with PTSD, trying to understand the financial complexities that they've just landed in and then receiving a long black and white letter telling them about all the things that they're now going to have to learn about. With all good intentions, we did receive complaints now and then about this letter because it just felt overwhelming. So that's the new revised letter that we're now using. So you can see there that we've focused on adding more colour. We have used the infographic approach where possible, so summarising critical concepts in visual ways. We've used really reassuring colour blocks, so we're blocking the headline message, so it's clear what this communication's about, and then if there's an action they need to take, we're blocking that action too. So we know from eye tracking research that people don't look at a whole document from the start to the end. We know that they will look at key points in a document. So helping people to take in information that we need to by understanding how the mind actually works. And using less words. As I said before, we tend to think more words is helpful, but often it's actually not helpful. So being brave and cutting out lots of words. So as I said before, we're in the midst of things. We're at a really exciting point. We'll be running the trial as the control trial until the end of the year. So we've got a little way to go now. This is it's a tail project. So we don't expect to see data now that will show us whether this is successful or not. We want to really give it adequate development time, so I'm sure the actuaries in the room want to see the numbers and we'd be happy to share the numbers in about 12 months, so hopefully you can wait. I didn't want to leave you empty-handed, so I did want to show you some of the positive indicators that we believe are showing that the interventions are working. So the first thing that I'll put your attention to is those faces there. So that's Jude and Lisa. And Jude and Lisa are two of our case managers working with the new case management model. They have volunteered to and taken their own photos and volunteered to share their photos with their medically discharged officers. And this is an act of faith and an act of reciprocity where our case managers are giving a bit of themselves. And by doing that, they're finding that they're getting so much more back from their medically discharged officers, and they're really starting to work in a way that will actually allow that collaborative goal setting that we know we need to engage in. So I don't know if you can see it from here, but the plans that we have up there give you an idea of the kinds of goals that people are working with. So the first one for Jude's medically discharged officer was to restore friendships with family and friends. So for some of our medically discharged officers, they're so isolated that that is their main goal in life, is just to try and reconnect with the community. So that's a really big focus for us, for our medically discharged officers who have been unwell for some time and who don't have a lot positive in their lives. So we're giving them something positive and something to focus on, and re-engaging with their family and their friends is a really protective factor. So we're really excited that people are coming up with these goals themselves. The second one is about being fit and healthy and returning to the workforce. So we're learning so much about people, and our case managers tell me they're so surprised with the beautiful stories and the beautiful plans and motivations for those plans that are coming through. And I suppose that's showing that these interventions are working, because where there was no trust, there was only fear and uncertainty, there's now this sharing of really personal and intimate goals and information about their lives. So finally, the verbatims that we've got scattered around there either come from our MPS loops, our customer feedback loop, or through direct feedback. And the main theme that you can see through there is that the courtesy call intervention is effective. This is showing that our medically discharged officers who didn't want to be contacted are now saying they feel they trust, they feel supported, and their case managers in the one in the centre here is one, Vince is one of my most trusted confidants. That case manager Vince nearly fell off his chair, and we all almost did, and it was quite an emotional response that we all had when we heard that, because it's such a long way from where we were such a short time ago. And the key for me in that is that this shows that we're on a path. We are moving towards an approach where people are trusting each other, and we know that collaborative planning can only succeed in that environment. So what happens next? We will scan up the interventions across the remaining case managers in this portfolio in early 2016 based on these early positive indications. We will share our learnings, like today, and we will learn from other similar projects to improve injury management practices in New South Wales, but hopefully further than that as well. And we'll follow our intervention cohort over the next 12 months with the support of our actuarial services team to determine the effects of the interventions on weekly benefit spend across payment types. I'm really interested as well to see, because this is opening up such different approaches to treatment and recovery, what types of investment in treatment are the ones that are going to lead to the quickest recovery. So there's a lot of exciting things to come. I'm total technophobe, so I'm really pleased that was my first stuff up of the slide the whole time. Thank you for listening. It's really nice to have such a big bunch of you here today.
Thanks, Rebecca. I thought that was fantastic. Particularly like the stimulus and response idea. I think next time I'm about to yell at my children, I might put that into practice. Does anyone want to kick off questions?
Thanks, Rebecca. Bruce Crossett from TAC. I just want to see if you'd thought about face-to-face contact versus, I'm assuming this is all happening over the phone in terms of the recovery plan, or if it isn't, Have you thought about whether you'll get even better outcomes if your people are out in the field having that face-to-face discussion with the worker around their plan and the goals that they want to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. When we were doing the preparation work with our case managers right at the start of the year, we were talking about communication and that the ultimate goal is always to have face-to-face communication, and that that's then followed by phone, and then that's then followed by written communication. So absolutely our wish is that we will get there, but I suppose this is a gradual process, and we have other parts of the business that are piloting those approaches. For us, we're just taking it step by step at the moment, and we've had some, I think because of the trust and the rapport that this is building, there's more and more engagement from our ex-police officers as well as from our case managers and desire to actually do that without being told they have to do that. So we've got people offering to meet and catch up for a coffee, and these things are happening organically. So it's really good to see.
Robert Auerbach, independent consultant. We've heard a lot, of course, about management and monitoring of scheme performance. And I was intrigued with your My Recovery Plan facet of the program. I was wondering, do you have any metrics in place to see how that particular portion is going? And apropos of that, are you familiar with the new initiative by Department of Veterans Affairs on their goal attainment scaling project?
No, you have to tell me more about that afterwards, Robert.
Oh, yeah, I'd like, love to, because they're doing a very similar kinds of, a kind of thing with a similar cohort, but they're actually turned it into a metric. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is, again, I think we're taking baby steps at the moment. We're really just testing this, and that's really one of the key features of a Behavioural Insights pilot is that you test that things are working. It's iterative. You see how you go. At the moment, I'm doing something really fun, which is a library of all of the different plans and goals. So I'm pulling things together in a way that we can see what are the key goals, what are the key plans, what are the ways that we support them, and then ideally through the data tracking, how that plays out.
Daniel Keating, Comcare. Have there been any unexpected ways in which it's been more difficult or easier to implement the change than you were expecting?
Yeah, wow. Oh, a few. It's been really hugely interesting to me. So I'm not a project manager. I've worked in leadership roles, and before this project, I've never run a project. And so I've always had a bit of a change management role in part of my leadership role, but this is big change. So I think I didn't really anticipate how big that change was, and I didn't probably appreciate the cycles that we would go through. We had some of those things, you know, where you know something's a good idea, but then it's really hard to do it, and you're not quite sure if you want to do it anymore when you're in the middle of something we talked about before, you know, training for a marathon and things like that. We had case managers who, when they were briefed last year, they went, wow, that sounds amazing. I can't wait to get rid of the traditional energy management plan, but I hope I'm not in the trial. So I think just the understanding that change is really hard for people, even if they believe in it wholeheartedly, that people need support day in, day out, and the importance of leadership and strength in leadership, especially the first-line managers, so that my team leaders are my everything in trying to run a project like this. I think that's the main lesson learned, that you can't be a project manager and really take responsibility for anything much. You need to have absolute engagement and the ear of your people through their leaders to make sure you're picking up on any little concerns along the way. And it has been really tricky too, because it is an iterative process. So people are very comfortable, even though they like the idea of change, they're very comfortable in their ways. So just constantly working with people to reassure them that it's okay. It's something that we're going to gradually improve and change as we go along, but just keep coming with us.
Hi, Andrew McInerney from Finity. Have you had to change caseloads much to accommodate what you're doing here? And I guess a second part to the question, are you finding that there's certain characteristics in claims managers that make them more or less amenable to going on the journey with you? For instance, an older case manager is better at it.
The caseload question is a good one. We haven't changed anything for our poor case managers. They are managing... I suppose we really wanted to prove that this model doesn't need... We don't need to create a lot of change for this model to work. The one thing that we... because it is a trial that we haven't yet invested in IT infrastructure support to make things easier. We've got plans to do that now that we can see that things are working. But it has been... It's been a huge... investment of our case managers to remodel the way that they work and their leaders to remodel the way that they work and really question the tasks they keep, delegation, all those sorts of things to really strip out the non-essentials for what a case manager does without reducing their caseload. And the second question has left my mind.
Characteristics of certain
I think the best thing that we did was in a couple of the workshops we asked people why they turned up for work that day. So not why do you come to work or why did you choose this job, why did you come to work today? And the answer to that question really defined the way that we worked with those people throughout the rest of the trial. Because most, if not all of them, said it was because they felt committed to their customer and that they didn't want to let them down, and they turned up that day because they wanted to make sure that if they needed them, they were there, that their payments went through, you know, that generally we're lucky enough to have people who really just care about people. And once you've got that and you understand that's their motivation, it's much easier to manage anything that comes along.
Hi, I'm Nina from the TAC. Excuse me, I just had a question about those lovely-looking letters that you've developed. I'm curious about the process that you went through to develop them and whether there was any pushback from a policy, work practice, legislative perspective.
I really like the visual and the name for the conference, The Road to Recovery, because when we went through this process, we wanted to map a journey of communication rather than reworking existing letters. So we looked at what are the points that we need to communicate along the recovery road for our medically discharged officers, and then developed letters, some based on letters we already had, but some brand new letters, looking for opportunities to celebrate success. We had a few little things like recognition of prior learning is something we do a lot for medically discharged officers because they don't realise that they've got some amazing transferable skills. So we spent a lot of money on RPLs and that was one of the examples where we had no letter already, but we thought this is a really positive opportunity for us to celebrate and congratulate them on well done and all the hard work you've done in the police force, and this is now being recognised for this qualification. In terms of any difficulties with working with, I think your question was around working with the regulator. Did you mean internal regulatory functions? Yeah. We were really lucky in that we had at our disposal resources from the Behavioural Insights team at DPC who, whenever we needed to brief anyone, would come in very official and very impressive and charming and talk to those people. So once you get someone on board with a concept, it tends to make everything else much easier. And I think I've heard that a few times today. The importance of stakeholder consultation. So I think that's one of my key learnings from this project as well, is talk to people early, engage them early, understand how they feel about things and then go from there rather than taking them something and asking for their approval. We pretty much had hands off once they were on board with the concepts and just a supportive function, really.
maybe one more.
Sorry for another question, but look, those of us who've dealt with police understand that it's a recognizable subculture. I'm wondering whether or not you found that the differences of police culture are, it helped you or hindered you, or does it make it more transferable or less transferable?
I've toed and froed with that a lot, actually. And what I've decided now is that it's not actually helpful to think about them as a group, because they're just like all of us. You can't think about how actuaries behave because they're all very individual. They might have some common threads, but at the end of the day, you know, looking at the biopsychosocial model, their social context is different, their psychological resilience is different, their life experiences are different. So I think we fall into trouble when we do think about them and limit ourselves to a subculture idea, but we absolutely can enhance the richness of our understanding of them by understanding that they've joined an organisation, and most of them have joined that organisation for really good reasons. So really thinking about, where possible, what the positive and protective factors are related to their choice to become a police officer, and using that to help engage with them.
Thanks, Rebecca. I think we're right on time. So one last round of applause for Rebecca.